This is a Collider.com audio interview.
Toughest question out of the way. You guys worked so hard on this movie. I know you worked years developing it with different studios to try to get it made. And I thought it was a great movie. Really, really impressed. Are you frustrated at all that Lionsgate is releasing this on September 7th against a movie with a similar demo going for it, you know, that could really hurt it, you know, sort of in the long run, financially? I mean, are you worried at all? Was it bugging?
No, because ours is better. I think, you know, look, picking a date is always a complicated challenge with so much product in the marketplace. I think, you know, we looked at every weekend and we chose this date. And certainly there is the possibility that some of the male audience would be split between the two. But I think that our movies are so different, and I think that we have a wider appeal movie. We didn't make a movie just for men. I think our movie kind of crosses all four boxes. I think we have a great mix of young and old, and I think that we felt that our cast and our movie could definitely stand the challenge. So.
Can you talk a little bit about the casting process and landing Russell and Christian?
Well, Russell was someone who I very much had in mind when I would talk with Kathy about this movie for several years, and I had met him several years ago when I was working on some other stuff, and was really interested in approaching him with this, and it was our first pass. He at one point was tied to Baz's movie, which made it seem like it wasn't going to happen, and then suddenly he became available, and that was really a motherlode for us, because I think he's perfect Ben Wade.
And also getting Christian?
Well, in the case of Christian, that was something I really opened my eyes to. He was someone who I sat down and met, and I was not sure, and I think I had never met him before and really admired his work, but wanted to make sure that I felt it in him. And I really did. I mean, I really felt an incredible passion for him, from him, for the role, and also was just really impressed with what he was going to bring to Dan Evans.
And also, Ben Foster has a really coming out in the film.
Yeah.
Can you talk about casting Ben and, you know, what he brought to the table? And
well, I think, I mean, you know, once we had Christian and Russell set, it, you know, Charlie Prince was really the coveted role, another coveted role in the script. And I think that because there aren't a lot of Westerns getting made, and there were a lot of boys that came out to read for that part, and it was a traditional audition process. I mean, anybody that wanted to have a shot at that part had to audition. So we did get a tremendous amount of actor interest, actors that haven't read for a part in years, willing to do it, to have a shot at it. And I think when Ben came in, and Jim and I talk about this being very similar to what happened with Angelina when we did Girl Interrupted. Sometimes an actor walks in a room and they just nail it in the space. And I think Ben had an incredible body language that he brought to the part, that just he was living in that when he was reading, and how he would, I mean, he didn't have a gun in the audition, but the way that he moved and the way that he had such a range of colors to offer Charlie Prince, where one could have read Charlie Prince and said, that's just, you know, he's a badass guy, you know, he's the vicious, you know, Ben brought almost a kind of a vulnerability to Charlie Prince, too, a way that strengthened and made an interesting relationship between he and his boss, you know, there was just, so he brought an innocence to Charlie Prince, he also brought a viciousness to Charlie Prince, and he also brought this incredible body language that was just so vivid in the room. It was kind of a no-brainer. When he left, we're like, oh, there's Charlie Prince.
The key for casting the film to me was to try and avoid the
cliche
stereotypes of the Western. A lot of times there, and we saw a lot of it, I mean, because we read for Charlie Prince, you got to see a lot of it in the sense of that I'm super tough, I'm super bad, I'm bad, I'm bad, I'm bad. And the key to conquering these roles from Bedway down is actually to bring a kind of ease to it. I mean, the great, whether you're talking about Anthony Hopkins in Silence of the Lambs or Russell Crowe in this movie or a lot of other interesting roles you might come upon, part of the seduction of this character is their ease, their comfort, their charm, which comes from not just twizzling their mustache every 3 seconds and doing kind of a Dick Dastardly impression, but from bringing a lot of humanity to the role.
And yet at the same time, this film really kind of harkens back to kind of the traditional Westerns at the same time, so I'm just wondering for you...
But the traditional Westerns are really mistyped as bad guy, good guy movies. Yeah. Most of them, you go back, who's the bad guy and the good guy in Shane? Shane's a killer, but he saves the family. Is Jack Palance wants them off his property? Is he bad? Is he good? Everything is gray in the great Westerns, and you can go back. The Searchers, is John Wayne a good guy or a bad guy? I think that's one of the great misconceptions about the Westerns and why they're dead, and I'd hope actually you guys to exhort you to avoid printing what isn't really true except for the worst Gene Autry movies, is that there really was never the black hat, white hat Western. John Wayne was a dark figure. 310 of Yuma, 1957, that's not a movie about clear-cut good guys and bad guys. Rio Grande, Rio Lobo, on and on I could go. These are all movies about the gray between good and bad. And I think part of the reason people have tuned out of the Western is this assumption that actually isn't borne out by reality, that they're somehow simplistic stories.
Clear-cut, where you know everything.
I think they sometimes have more in common with, like, Taxi Driver than they do with the simplistic movies might have been, you know, Steve Reeves' Hercules movies. But the fact is that the Westerns never were.
The Westerns were, back then, they were able to say things that you couldn't say in other kinds of movies. How does the Western apply today? What can you use the Western for today?
I think we're exploring similar things. I mean, I think that one of the things the Western gave us an opportunity to do, and I don't think it's particularly obtuse, is explore a lot of issues today in the context of the post-Civil War period in America and allow you to see them allegorically instead of directly. And it makes the film less preachy. It makes the film less of a kind of political didactic experience and much more of a film where you experience, wow, I didn't know that voluntary militiamen were drawn into the Civil War, even if they didn't want to be. And I didn't know, and even just exploring, you know, I would always joke with Peter Fonda that he was kind of playing Dick Cheney, that that the kind of use of God to justify violence on both sides, you know, that Ben Wade will justify violence using a kind of, an anarchy or a kind of almost libertarian philosophy of survival of the fittest, and at the other side of the spectrum you have Peter Fonda, who's kind of using violence justified by law and order. And both of them are quoting the Bible to justify their actions. And I think that a lot of that becomes a way to play out things without making political points, but actually drawing an audience into something where they just might be left thinking in a way that we haven't divided people.
You were a great fan of the original movie. And I was wondering, because you changed it, you changed the end, without giving the end away, you changed the end. And I just kind of wondered, why did you decide, or what went into all of the changes that you decided to put into this film?
Well, we changed more than the end.
Yeah.
I mean, we changed the beginning. We changed, I could rifle him off. Dan Evans doesn't have one leg in the original, and he's not a Civil War veteran, and his son doesn't travel with them, and... you should see the original then.
You told me the end was changed.
Right. That's the dangerous thing with the someone told me stuff for press. But there's an awful lot. There's a huge journey, a 3-day journey that doesn't exist in the original film. There's the son isn't present in the ending in the original. But I think what you should do is watch the original ending and see. I think that's one of the weaker areas of the original. So and one of the more implausible, frankly. But I mean that we felt we were making a commentary on what we felt was kind of a more evocative and realistic appraisal of what might actually have happened.
Yeah. What were the advantages of remaking a movie that's not, you know, held up like Gone with the Wind, or was, you know, a true classic, but a movie that's a good movie that people really don't recognize today?
Well, I think when Jim and I always talk about what material would be a good remake, it always comes down to, you know, a broken, something that's broken in the original that can be looked at from another point of view, or something that isn't fully reached its potential, that there isn't. I mean, no one wants to remake a great. I mean, I don't think it's an ambition to remake something that was already great. I think if there's still a theme or an idea that's still relevant, and something like as Jim was saying, in the original, we loved it and we watched it many, many times. And I think the thing we always asked ourselves when it was over, which is, wow, this movie implies a journey, but the whole second act is missing. Like, we never saw them go anywhere. You know, they left a town and ended up in another town. And there's a huge middle part of a psychological cat and mouse that could be played out between these two characters, and how they get under each other's skin a little bit more could be much more rewarding if we actually sent them on the journey. And that was kind of the way we began to sort of look at it. And then, of course, adding the son and making more of a relationship about the fathers and the son, about a father and a son in this journey under these circumstances. So it just had holes in it that we thought that we could fulfill with a different, with a fresh way of looking at it.
Can you talk about, oh, sorry.
Well, no, the only thing I was going to add is that I think that the word remake has come to mean one thing, and I think it's very different in the case of films like ours, which is that there's this very cynical kind of remake in Hollywood where you have a brand of a toy or a TV show from the 70s or whatever it is, and you take some modern stars and $70 million and you throw it all together and you have asses in seats because everyone recognizes the brand. With 3:10 to Yuma, your point is that there's probably 1% of 1% of America is even aware of the title. So we weren't getting any kind of innate cynical advantage, which is usually implied when you're saying remake, like, oh, it's easy work, your story's laid out for you, and there's instant appeal with everyone in America. We have a genre that no studio believes anyone wants to see anymore. We have a story no one's ever heard of before. So that in a sense, we were really...
And no one really knew who starred in the original
anyway. No one knew who starred in the original. So in a way, we really had our work cut out for us. I think the example I'd use is, I do think the original film is great.
Yeah.
I do think that the... I do think, though, that there's a chance sometimes to remake... When movies aren't legendary or haven't become iconographic, there is the chance. You know, how many Hamlets have been made? How many Macbeths have been made? How many? Well, we have in this country also kind of really wonderful mythic timeless texts, and there are times where it might be interesting to bring a contemporary point of view to one of these stories. Instead of half the time, what Hollywood does is remake the movie from the side, which is keep all the story elements but deny that you're just doing a mirror of the original film. Why not just be honest about it and do that text again? And that's exactly what we kind of just thought we'd do.
The Western genre kind of, the golden age kind of ended a while ago. So how was it like bringing it sort of back? You know, how did you make it more appealing to the modern audience, which expects more whistles and bells and a lot more high definition
stuff? Well, given that the modern audience hasn't seen it yet,
we'll see.
But I mean, I think that we are believers and always have been, and we felt this way when we went to make Walk the Line, where there was a lot of non-believers about that genre as well. What we believe is, we believe that the story, Western element aside, is a great story between two men. It's a great dramatic tale, you know. And I mean, if you have a good central premise, the idea of the Western, I think, got really as bastardized as time went on. People have this idea in their head that's a bit of a cliche. You know, the shoot 'em up, bang bang, you know, Knott's Berry Farm, you know, signs creaking and all this stuff that really work against what some of the more classic Westerns actually endeavored to do. And I think that, you know, it was a struggle with the studios to explain to them that they shouldn't be afraid of something that they haven't made in a long time. You know,
it's an opportunity, and
that it's actually an opportunity to start something again, which is, it's just another way to tell a great story, another template that's available to us that no one has taken advantage of. So
what's your selling point then when you do go to a studio and say, we're going to
We lost. No one wanted to make it.
We got independent financing. That was our selling point.
The other thing I think is a selling point of the film, and I do think there's an exhaustion factor, is how many times are we going to see young stars of the day in spandex in front of a green screen with some flying background? And I'm, if I can do it on my Xbox, and I can do it on my you know, PlayStation, I can see it every week running on HBO. I'm like, is it going to stay exciting? And is there something exciting about a bunch of men and women going out into the desert and making a film with their hands and their feet and the hooves and the
reins very raw and the
wheels and the guns Western. And there are no green screens Specialist. And there is no baloney, and it wasn't shot in LA or in Pinewood or any of that. It's like we're out there, and when it's snowing in the movie. And that there's something I think appealing about that we've lost in movies as they become more and more kind of digitized. And this is a very analog film, and I think there's a way that could be very appealing.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I was just going to ask real quick, though, could you talk about the things you might be working on in the future? project?
Well, I'm working on a script right now, but I'm not going to talk about it. But the but we're in the midst of figuring out something very different than this, as is our pattern.
Cool. Thank you.
Thank you.